Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon to your friends. This is our host, Tom Sonic from Croatia. And I'm very pleased again to have a good friend of mine and also a good guest. And this is Jonathan Bowden. Hello, Jonathan. Can you hear me well?
Yes, hello. Greetings from Britain.
Listen, Jonathan, I'm very, very pleased to have you on my show for a variety of reasons. And what I would like to do today is the following thing. In the first segment, I'd like you first to say a few words about yourself, about your background, and about your political background as well. And then in the second segment, we'll talk a little bit about your literary and artistic accomplishment. But let's first start with yourself, Jonathan. Don't be too shy. Just tell me what you got, because you're a man. You have a heavy artillery. And that's, I am very pleased to have you indeed on my show.
Yes, well, I'd like to say hello to everyone who may be out there in the ether. I was born in England, in Kent, in a part of southeastern England, so-called the Garden of England, in 1962, so I'm sort of 48 now. And during the almost entirety of my educated lifetime, liberal ideas of one sort or another, libertarian, centre-left, far-left ideas, have been hegemonic and dominant amongst most educated people in Britain and elsewhere. It may come as sort of news to people, particularly in the United States, that there is really very little freedom of expression in Britain and in parts of Western Europe about certain key matters. It's rather ironic because probably the rest of the world thinks that, you know, opinion was free here, and the Second European Civil War, what I call the Second World War, was fought for freedom of expression and so on, whereas there's no First Amendment right here, and there are many ways in which discussion is curtailed. But I think that's rather ironic, because having a discussion indicates that you have something to suppress, when in actual fact, most educated and artistic people in England and Britain now are vaguely liberal-minded, or at the very least, they go along with what's called a politically correct mindset. Now this has grown up over the last 40 to 50 years since the sort of Cultural Revolution of the 1960s in Britain and elsewhere across the West. And you have a sort of situation now where almost everybody who goes through tertiary and even higher secondary education comes out with a slightly identical formulation, the same sort of views about certain core issues, or the same belief that certain topics are unsayable or are off-limits, particularly about generic inequality or biological differences between people or inherent differences between male and female. Another difference, particularly with American listeners, is almost the complete collapse of Christianity in England and Britain. We've had, of course, a state semi-Protestant church for half a millennia called the Church of England. I was baptized in it. I was confirmed in it, as 30 million English people were, and yet it is largely invisible and is kept alive by the residual liberals in its hierarchy and many of the immigrants from the Third World via the British Empire who were given the religion externally and, of course, who still believe in its precepts. Mm. You have the paradox that many of the immigrants who are Anglicans now and have come in from the outside are more socially conservative and come from more psychologically conservative cultures than the hierarchy of their own church. But that's a minor cultural war, increasingly on the margins of English life. But it would be wrong to say that many Judeo-Christian assumptions have gone. They've been secularized and have taken a humanist form.
Ambiance, so to speak, how did that affect your formative years, let's say 20, 30 years ago, when you went to grammar school and afterwards when you went to the university? Could you tell me something about that? Because as I understand, back then, the left did not hold such a firm grip on cultural power.
Yes, that's contradictory. Saying I was about 18, coming on 20, when Margaret Thatcher came to power in Britain. And it's paradoxical that the liberal left was not so entrenched in establishmentarian discourse then as now, the better part of 30 years on. However, the far left, by which we mean a sort of Trotskyite, sort of ultra-left, and sort of leftish reaches of communism, people who looked down on the Communist Party of Great Britain, which was to wind up in 1990 with the collapse of the Soviet Union that partly financed it, they had enormous power, at least at the level of the street, by which I mean in campuses, they had the power to break the windows of dons who had ideas that they disapproved of. particularly in the biological sciences, but also in psychology and culture and elsewhere. Well, one of the great, I joined the Conservative Party, which is the equivalent of the Republican Party in the United States, and centre-left, right, Christian Democrat parties throughout Western Europe when I was about 18. And the interesting thing about the Conservative Party is that, one, it ceased to be culturally conservative in a metaphysical sense a long time ago, and two, it has never understood the cultural struggle that the radical left has waged inside European societies, which includes Britain and indeed the United States. Conservatism has never conserved anything for about 40 to 50 years, and because it allowed the arts and the media and the academy and much of the terracy and intelligentsia to be completely penetrated by the ideas of their sworn enemies, you've ended up in Britain and elsewhere with this strange hybrid of a left-wing capitalist society,
and how do you
which
explain
is the sort
that?
Of norm across the West.
How do you explain that? Why did they? Why were they so able? You're talking, of course, about the leftists. So how did they permeate and infiltrate into the mainstream opinion-making?
I think it's two ways. I think there's an external or an exterior strategy, and there was an interior strategy. I think the exterior one is by pressure groups, by proselytization, by student militancy, by the militants of today who tone it down and become the dons of tomorrow. But I think there's also an internal element. I think many people internalize the idea that right-wing values, elitist values, values of prior identity, values of belief in hierarchies and so on, were somehow wrong or vaguely immoral or amoral or non-permissible or in a much more mercenary way, wouldn't sort of foster one's career too much in the future. So the moral uncertainty of certain people, even on the moderate right, meant that they had partly internally collapsed in relation to a range of ideas. I also think it's important to understand that the left understood that it had lost the battle over the economy several generations back, and since Gramsci, in the latter part of the second decade of the 20th century, had been fighting various forms of cultural war, primarily against conservative opponents who were increasingly mentally defenseless against them. Unlike the moderate left that's always seen far-left ideas shorn of communist politics as a permissible ally, the moderate right has always seen far-right and radical right ideas as part of the enemy mix or an area that they can't go to. And so you have this paradox that there were certain very radical conservative, metaphysically and intellectually conservative dons in English life, Maurice Cowling at Cambridge, about whom I've given a talk somewhere on the internet, and Professor Roger Scruton, who's still alive. They're known as Deep Blue, or metaphysical conservatives. They're the last of a sort of dying breed, if you like. But even they were resistant to the idea of using far-right ideas against the left and the liberal left on campus.
Well, let me just clarify one thing, Jonathan, if you don't mind. Till about 40 years, you remember Enoch Powell, you know, what he said, and he was a very prominent politician. But nowadays, he would be clearly dismissed as a fascist, an ultra-fascist. And so basically, we're talking about this, those semantic distortions, or what I keep repeating over and over again. What was considered quite normal, decent, mainstream right in the UK, or for that matter, in continental Europe, 30 years ago, nowadays is considered an extreme right.
Yes, that's right. It's as if you've had a shuffling to the left in all areas, in religion, in the media, in the academy, in the arts, in the general clerisy, even in the sort of semi-sciences, the humanistic sciences and the social sciences, and even in the softer parts of the hard sciences. So you've had a shift to the left in all areas. Enoch Powell's an interesting example. Like Nietzsche, who was given a sort of university professorship when he was 24, Powell was given a professorship at the University of Sydney in Australia when he was 24 years of age. Powell could speak 10 European languages.
Well, you're talking about Enoch Powell. You're talking about Powell, right? Did you know him personally? Did you ever meet him?
I met him towards the end of his life. Like a lot of allegedly dictatorial men, he was extraordinarily short. He used to stand on a box to address meetings that was concealed behind the podium. You know, he came from quite a long line of sort of Napoleon-esque men in various ways. The irony is that Powell was, in many respects, an extremely right-wing liberal. He was at the outermost cusp of the old Tory party. He was very much an economic liberal, very anti-statist, very anti-socialist, some of his values were not far right at all, but would be so close to economically people like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich von Hayek and the Austrian school. Don't forget the great reaction in Britain is against the post-war planned welfare state, deficit financing and Keynesianism. So many fiscal conservatives looked to be in that sort of area and wouldn't be regarded as radical right at all. On certain other areas, power was out of grain with what might be called a compassionate society. He was Minister of Health in the 1950s, and you may remember there was a scandal about birth defects with a drug called thalidomide, and he had to deal with that. And he was, although he turned to Christianity in his middle life, a high church, high Anglican, Anglo-Catholic type of Christianity, a bit like T.S. Eliot, the poet, early in his life, and Power was also a poet, actually, he'd been very strongly influenced by Nietzsche, and that certain intellectual implacability influenced Powell throughout his life. Powell's most famous with the masses for speaking out against mass third world immigration into Britain in the late 1960s, which catapulted him from obscure Tory ministerial ambition to be somebody that skinheads and football fans and the overwhelming mass of the population heard of. And he then became one of the most significant men in the country because he dared to speak about issues which virtually no one else in the establishment would. Powell was an outsider in many ways. Despite his intellectual accomplishments, he was seen as an outsider. He didn't obtain the leadership of the Conservative Party in and around 1970. He later advocated that people should vote Labour in order to get a referendum or membership of the European Union, the sort of putative federation that exists in this part of the world, that right-wing, nativist and nationalistic people across Europe tend to oppose. Not all, but most of them do. He was an Ulster Unionist, of course, which got him involved in radical Protestant-type politics in relation to the sort of war that people will have heard of in Northern Ireland. But Powell was one of these figures that Britain has grown up in the last 100 years, Joseph Chamberlain at the beginning of the 20th century, Throstle Mosley in the middle of the 20th century, and Enoch Powell at the end of the 20th century, who posited an alternative political trajectory for Britain. They were very radical men. They didn't really have an allegiance to party, hence there's a nationalistic strand to all of them. Powell was a member of the Tory Party, a member of the Ulster Unionist Party, advocated voting Labour at times tactically. Mosley was a member of both the Tory and the Labour parties before he founded a new party that then became the British Union of Fascists in the 1930s. Joseph Chamberlain began in the Liberal Party, then formed his own Liberal Unionist Party, then moved over to the Tories. The Liberal Unionists were probably proto-fascistic in the late years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century.
Jonathan, how did it affect your trajectory, if I can put it that way? Because you had at some point a couple of years ago quite a prominent role as a cultural advisor for Nick Griffin. I don't want to get into those squabbles and what happened, but could you just give us a rough idea to what extent that Enoch Powell and then Tyndall, how did it affect your political, in this particular case, your political trajectory, not intellectual so much?
Yes, I mean, politically, in some ways the two are combined, because the one thing I always thought about conservatism, even very right-wing conservatism, is Powell to one side. There's a great cultural aridness there. There's a strong anti-intellectuality and philistinism in conservatism per se, particularly its British example. You know, philosophy is taught in France from the age of six, but the British culture, particularly English culture, is strongly pragmatic, strongly sort of non-heuristic, is anti-conceptual, practical and pragmatic and utilitarian. Margaret Thatcher was a scientist, and it showed in the politics, and particularly the cultural politics of her government. When you bear in mind that she had as much power as Reagan had in the United States, particularly in the first term, and yet virtually nothing was done with this cultural power. There was a few items, a minor issue about homosexuality, the so-called Clause 28, and tacit support for white South Africa. But apart from these things, you know, all other institutions, in particular the BBC, were left in the hands of her most sort of ferocious opponents.
You mean leftists?
And it's partly this inability to see where your enemies are and know where they are. And it's also the absence of a complete sort of what you might call civilizational discourse that many conservative politicians had that led me to look at political tendencies further out, if you like.
Sure. Jonathan, let me just focus for a while on your specific case. You were pretty much active, first with the BNP, and now you, quote-unquote, you still figure as a chief intellectual leader of the English or the British New Right. So could you give me some specific details about your political and intellectual trajectory over the last 10 years?
Yeah, in the last 20, actually. The early 1990s, I was in the accredited right-wing group on the right wing of the Conservative Party, which then called itself the Conservative and Unionist Party. This was a group called the Mundy Club, which went back to the late 1960s and was created by the Marquess of Salisbury, who, of course, is related to the aristocratic British Prime Minister, Lord Salisbury, 70 years before in the last years of the 19th century. The Mundy Club, of course, deliberately chose that name so that there would be no far-right subliminal messages, because they first had their meeting on a Monday, so they called themselves the Mundy Club, the most neutral name in the world. The Mundy Club was a significant organisation in the 1970s. By the time I joined it, it was well and truly dying. I formed a metapolitical group of my own called Revolutionary Conservative at that time that lasted for a few years, and I was also the deputy chairman of quite a notorious group, actually, called Western Goals, which was an extreme anti-sort of communist and Cold War group. I sort of went through that phase, if you like. I had my sort of Cold War warrior phase on the Western side, if you like. Those groups were quite interesting because they did consist of people from the conservative right and people from the far right who rubbed shoulders with each other. Mm-hmm. It was a sort of reverse alliance of the Second World War, do you see what I mean? It was right-wing conservatives and far-rightists against communism. The interesting thing about the World Anti-Communist League, which was the organisation that Western Goals was affiliated with, was that it contained anti-communists of every race and type right across the world. It had some very notorious affiliates in Latin America, in Asia, in Africa, and that sort of thing. General Singlaub, who was head of the National Security Council, and Jimmy Carter came across and gave us a tour once. And I like these American sort of generals very much as individuals. But even then, because they're very brave men, you know, but they were warriors. And you had to wonder, in your inner mind, did they really know what cause they were fighting for? And John Singlaub had fought in 10 wars across his lifetime. He'd fought for the American Empire, as even he called it privately, all his life. And he was a fascinating man. So just as sort of artistically and intellectually and psychologically, it's interesting to meet some of these types who do sort of partly run the world. Carter sacked him, of course, because he accused Carter of being soft on communism. Then after the Cold War was basically won, I moved slightly further out and became more and more enamoured of cultural struggle. I was in a group called the Bloomsbury Forum, published a few things. And I had a little group of my own called the Spinning Top Club, which was a sort of metapolitical group, but that was largely a group of friends. Then I became increasingly involved in and around the edge of the British National Party. I was involved in a breakaway tendency from that, in some respects, called the Freedom Party. And then in 2003, I joined the BNP and I became cultural officer for about 4 years thereafter. And I was in this tendency, which I still am chairman of now, called the New Right.
Jonathan, let me ask you, I hope it's not too personal question, do you still have contacts with the BNP specifically? Are you in touch with Nick Griffin?
Griffin and I don't really get on, but that doesn't really matter. I still speak at their meetings. I still have some residual cultural influence with them. Lots of people think I'm too right-wing for the BNP, actually. It's a great paradox that's happened. Because it's strange, given that I seem to have started as a conservative, in my own mind, of course, my views have hardly changed. The perception of them has changed a great deal. But my views are always philosophically based, and I'm a very unusual British right-wing in some way.
Very much so. In fact, I was going to point that out to our listeners, that you seem to combine this militant political activism just as much as you're skilled and very much adept at writing excellent pieces and also giving good lectures on Carlyle or Nietzsche and Jünger, and we'll talk about this in our next segment. But back a little bit to this political life of yours. So I understand now you don't have any specific official ties with the BNP. Am I correct?
That's right. People announce me as sort of cultural officer and that sort of thing, but that's something to say at meetings, really. But I tend to think I've always seen my role as very similar to that of a Marxist intellectual in reverse. If you take the small parties of the British far left that electorally never got anywhere, but culturally have been very significant, parties like the Socialist Workers' Party and Militant and the Workers' Revolutionary Party and these sorts of groups, they would have had Marxist academics and Marxist intellectuals who passed through them, who often were members, who had cultural or metapolitical roles, sometimes critical of the narrow sectarian leaderships of such parties and so on. Intellectual like the Greek-originated Alex Kalinikos in the Socialist Workers' Party. And I see myself the other way around. I see myself as a sort of Nietzschean or a post-Nietzschean who has been in various right-wing political parties and groups, attempting to, you know, educate people, attempting to culturalize various things, attempting to put things in a broader context, trying to get people to understand that it's not just about immigration and leaving the European Union, you know, or in an American context, it's just not about gun control, absence of gun control, states' rights, immigration, who controls the media, and these sorts of issues that the right at its best should basically stand for the advance of Western civilization. And that means you have to know something about the civilization that you're attempting to push forwards, if you see what I mean.
Sure, by all means. We'll definitely discuss, folks, a little bit more about cultural hegemony and about some of artistic works by our friend, author Jonathan Bowden, in our next segment. But Jonathan, back a little bit on those technical issues. So I understand this new right in Great Britain now. I know some people, our common friend Troy Southgate, and yes. I understand there are some more folks. I mean, do you have some loose structure? Do you have hold some meetings? Or what specifically is the goal of the British New Right, including Troy Southgate? I'm sure you're in touch with him.
Yes, he's the organizing secretary of the group. I mean, in some ways, the New Right's a bigger and better continuation of some of the sort of smaller metapolitical groups I've mentioned in the last sort of couple of minutes. It's gone on for about 4 to 5 years now. It's had about 26 through 30 meetings and a couple of dinners, 5 magazines. It's managed to, now that this is very much the internet age, you can speak to 50 to 60 people in a room, and tens of thousands of people, if they want, can see the thing or hear the thing later on the World Wide Web. The term New Right confuses people, of course. It's a relatively neutral term. It's not as intellectually and culturally coherent in the sense of de Benoist's French New Right or Stoïcism's Belgian version.
I'm glad you pointed that out.
It's a synthetic-like group that consists of different and even old-right tendencies, if truth be told.
I'm glad you pointed that out because I had a discussion both private and on a VOR show about with Alain de Benoist about this conceptual problem as to how the New Right is being defined or interpreted or instrumentalized in the UK or as it is in as opposed to France. So this causes sometimes some frictions, definitely. Go ahead.
Yes, it's sort of, it's partly a Britishness, of course, because it is, many British intellectuals, for example, are uncomfortable even with the word intellectual. So British intellectual life, when it takes a political form, tends to be less purist and less sectarian. French and continental intellectuals love tiny little tendencies, you know, that are completely pure, and people who don't leave, who can't stand it, leave and form a trajectory of their own. Whereas our group tends to be more of a synthesis. It's basically a generalized right-wing philosophical circle which allows freedom of speech. This is particularly in a culture where there is not freedom of speech about quite a lot of salient matters. And you have to be quite careful about the speech, even within this space, that you put forward. And also, it's there's a general sort of premise. It's rather, even for a very ideological group, there's a streak of English pragmatism to it. It creates a creative space for people to put forward educated, hopefully reasonably highly educated, in egalitarian views. Probably about 5% of it, in truth, would be consonant with Gress and what they formulate. Probably intellectually, Gress has had more influence in the United States.
Yes, Jonathan, we'll just take a little bit break and then we'll continue our discussion in our next segment. Don't go away, folks. We'll be right back. Hello back, folks. This is Tom Sunick, and I'm again pleased to reintroduce a friend of mine and a good author and accomplished artist, Jonathan Bowden. Jonathan, welcome back.
Welcome back.
Oh, thanks. We just left off with the cultural hegemony. Well, let me read a little paragraph of yours, which I think is very fascinating and which serves almost like a framework for our discussion. Politics is just a sideline, you see. Artistic activity is what really matters. As Bill Hopkins once told me, one man set writing alone in a room can alter the entire cosmos. It is the ability, through a typewriter or whatever else, to radically transform the consciousness of one's time. Cultural struggle is the most interesting diversion of all. This is what you said verbatim to Troy Southgate. Could you please comment a little bit on that, on cultural struggle, and how you see it exactly from this, from our contemporary perspective, and from the British perspective?
Yeah, I think politics is limited in a way in this era. I think this is quite true when you look at the vote that radical right parties beyond the accredited centre-right get. They come up, they go down. I suppose the party in Belgium, the Vlaams Belang, once the Vlaams Blok, and Jean-Marie Le Pen's organisation in the French Fifth Republic, the Front National, have done the best on the western side of the continent, but even they are partly peripheral, demonised, out of power, and very far away from even having a hand upon the hand that controls the tiller of their respective states. So I think one of the many reasons for this is that the entire culture, with the odd exception, maybe in relation to market economy performance in a liberal way, is stressing humanistic and egalitarian goals. The entire zeitgeist is against you, or seems to be so. And therefore, I think that you have to sit, as Gramsci and other leftists did 90 to 100 years ago, and work out what can be done to push the culture back in a more organic, more traditional, more elitist, more hierarchical way, however you want to look at it. And therefore, I think that cultural struggle, particularly in the arts, I think especially in the arts, because I see the arts as the dream space or the subconsciousness, if you want to use that phrase, mm-hmm. of the society, I think it's extraordinarily interesting and or important, and it's really my fundamental interest to see what can be done in that area, and whether what situationist, the theory that came out of surrealism and influenced the leftist events of May 1968 in Paris and America and elsewhere, whether you can engage in what they call detournement, this idea that you can turn around the mm-hmm. specificity of the moment, and you can invert, in many ways, the cultural inversion of the last 40 to 50 years. Is it possible? Liberals would say, is it desirable? But can it be done? And in what ways can it be done? I think particularly, because I take an elitist view of culture, I believe that everything comes down from above, and I believe that the spirit of the brain is the mind, and the mind dominates the body. But the mind is also a part of the body. And I think, rather like Hobbes, the great English theorist of 400-odd years ago, against whom British cultural theory reacted. Hobbes was an authoritarian, an absolutist, a semi-elitist, a non-democrat, and even an atheist in a deeply religious age. So he was quite a shocking combination. He appalled both the royalists and the Cromwellians. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite enamoured of Hobbes in a way, who of course is close to the English version of Machiavelli in his Doctrine of Statecraft. And Hobbes' idea of the society that's organic and where the mind and the body are integrated influences me a great deal. I think the contemporary West suffers from an extraordinary mind-body split. Mm. And the intelligentsia has gone off and talks to themselves and doesn't connect to the bulk of people in Western societies at all. And there is a degree to which I personally think if you put into recurrency ideas and cultural forms which have a primal element, have a primordial element, have in some respects a pagan dimension, I think you can knit the mind and the body back together again. I also think it's very important, something that political people nearly always miss, that rationalism is not enough. I think you move people at a level beneath the mind, physiologically, and in terms of the emotions. I think, in fact, the right is most powerful when it appeals to the subconscious as much as the conscious mind. And I think an enormous number of people, including the right's bitterest and harshest opponents, are slightly subconsciously attracted to it in spite of themselves. That's why they can never stop talking about it, even from an oppositional perspective. And I do believe in cultural inversion, that you can get into the subconsciousness of the era that you're in and begin to turn it around. I'm also very aware that movements of the 20s and 30s were based upon, in part, a romantic counterculture that stretches back to the 1870s, if not before. And the counterculture as we perceive it is purely leftist and comes from the 1960s. And yet, the artistic community, I agree with Ezra Pound, rather, that the artistic community is in some ways the antennae of the civilization that they're a part of. And that they feel the tremors in the web, or in the ether, before anyone else. That's why a lot of 20th century art is about trauma and alienation and ugliness and neurosis, because that's what the intelligentsia feel. And that's what the artistic part of the intelligentsia feel. But I see right-wing cultural formations everywhere, even though they wear other hats, even though they seem to be denouncing the right. But you have to view these areas artistically and not completely in a linear or rational way.
You mentioned Hobbes, so how do you actually square away Hobbes now with our modern society?
Yes, well, I think British and English theory reacted against Hobbes, and English Enlightenment, Scottish Enlightenment thinking is a reaction against him. Hobbes is interesting because he's so modern, sort of ferocious and contemporary. It's amazing to think it's 400 years ago, but the climactic events of English history, certainly the internally violent events, are 400 years ago. We only ever had one Puritan revolutionary military dictator, and it's 400 years ago. We've only ever had one republic, and that's 400 years ago. So the elements of Hobbes that interest me are the closeness to Machiavelli, but the idea of an organic society where mind and body are synchronized with each other. And I think modern culture suffers from an enormous mind-body split, a Descartesian split. About 140-odd years ago, artists and intellectuals began creating totally for themselves. And, if you like, divested themselves of the mass of the population and have been talking to themselves partly since. And that's partly a good thing, partly a very bad thing. And I think if you can knit the mind and the body back together again in various subtle ways, great changes can occur, but they won't be immediately obvious. Artistic activity is extraordinarily important, and the arts are not really, although they appear to be, completely in the hands of the enemies of our point of view. I don't always think that is the case if you view the arts in a different way. I think sort of rightist ideas, or let's call them conceptually elitist notions, are ubiquitous, even when they're being traduced and denounced. And I think that a different perspective on these sorts of things can lead to turnaround. Inversion of the inversion and attacks upon liberal definitions of culture, even from within what it's saying. But these are very complicated areas, and on the whole, political people have almost no time for this, and I think don't often understand the dynamics of the artistic space, which is why they've left it to people who are interested in these areas, and in this era, and the one that precedes it, that's congruent with their most significant opponents.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, let me ask you one thing which is quite conspicuous. I come across in your writing quite often. This is elitism. I certainly would appreciate if you could define it a little bit. So let me just read a sentence of yours. A man who possesses an idea or a spiritual truth is the equivalent of 50 men. Every pundit, tame journalist, academic, or mainstream politician is a mouthing hand-me-down ideas from a philosopher of yesteryear. I just want to make sure I understand that correctly. So basically, yes, I understand we both reject egalitarianism and economism, but at the same time, just in terms of conceptualizing our objective reality, it seems to me that you sometimes use a language which is a little bit too arcane, if I can put it modestly.
Yes. That particular set of ideas in some ways comes from an artist and a writer who would be regarded as a leftist. George Bernard Shaw.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I'm interested in is the reclamation of certain people who were once regarded as left-wing. I think, although it's a small amount of mileage, there is a tiny bit of mileage in these very elitist, extremely culturally knowledgeable people of 100 years ago and more who were on the left then. People like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw and some, but not all of the Fabians here, people like Jack London in a complicated way in the United
sure.
States at the same time. Now, there is a complication with them because increasingly these figures, and Shaw was influenced by both Wagner and Nietzsche, he's this odd commingling of Marx and Wagner, an interesting synthesis if you like, and I personally think these figures are now too white, too Eurocentric, too knowledgeable about the classical world, and I think they make the contemporary new left quite uncomfortable. And there's a certain energy to their criticism which can be made use of. William Pierce from National Alliance, of course, was heavily influenced by Man and Superman and by quite a few of Shaw's more elitist and dissentient ideas. Even though I'm a pagan and a Nietzschean, even though I wonder if the supernatural actually exists, in a factual sense rather than a metaphorical and aesthetic one, I do believe that the ultimate truth is religious and the ultimate truth is outside man,
mm-hmm.
and that we are not aware of what that ultimate truth may be, and the Western post-Socratic tradition is an opening out to the possibility of that rather than a declamatory affirmation of what it is.
Let me ask you a question. Are you a pagan? Are you a Christian? Are you a religious person? Of course. But how would you define yourself, if I may ask you that?
I would say I was a spiritual person rather than a religious person. I believe in having what the Benoit calls a sense of the sacred. Mm-hmm. I'm a pagan. I've attended pagan events. I'm aware that metaphysically objectivist pagans, as I would call them, who believe that Odin and Thor and Loki and all the others physically exist in another realm. I'm less certain about that. I don't mind those beliefs. But I personally think that is not the issue with religion. Religion, to me, deals with emotional rather than normative or factual or empirical truth. Emotional truth is far more powerful and is ultimately what draws the energy of civilizations together, what creates great ecstasies, what creates great waves of creation and destruction, what creates great civilizations and prepares for their fall.
Okay,
and
Jonathan, but where's the spiritual? You're talking about the emotional. How about the spiritual aspect?
I personally think that the heightened creative energy that comes from emotionally based rationality reaches the spiritual. But for me, artistic activity is probably the nearest that I get to belief. To me, it's a form of religious belief. So just take one example that convulsed contemporary culture quite recently in the United States and all over the world. I went to a Catholic school, but I went as a Protestant, and I'm not a Christian, retrospectively. But Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, which had an enormous impact all over the world, to me is extraordinarily interesting, and is a spiritual as well as a cultural event. But primarily is an artistic phenomenon of immense power, whatever prior system one adheres to.
Mm-hmm.
See, I don't think the West has a prior system. I agree with Evola that when he was asked, what is your religion? He said, I'm a Catholic pagan.
Good point.
And I think
yes.
The West has a dialectic that's both Christian and pagan fused together.
No. Jonathan, I noticed, of course, in your artistic work, and I'd like to focus a little bit on that, and also in your prose, I've noticed this almost obsession, if I can put it that way, with the gothic and the macabre. Why is that?
Yes, I do love the macabre. I think that's where part of the power in art is. Yeah, I see politics and art in a slightly occultistic way. If you attend a far-right meeting, it's not a conservative meeting at all, but many of the views expressed are extremely conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that left-wing people are rebels. Conservative people are conformists, and radically right-wing people are rebellious conformists. And in the occult, if you like, you have a destructive potentiality, which is the left, and you have a concrete and stabilizing force, which is the right. And yet, the energy comes from the left onto the right to energize it and to reformulate the nature of civilization and its discourse. And therefore, I see partly the ultra-right as having certain energies which are drawn from the left and are purified by the right and then move further out because there isn't room elsewhere on the spectrum for them. Mm. So I see the right as partly demonic in the sense that Goethe meant, partly Mephistophelian. Although these are dangerous areas, of course, the primal cultural spaces are dangerous. The reason that the far right is vilified and demonized all over the Western world is because it represents the fundamentalist energies of its own culture.
This is a fascinating statement of yours, but would you just elaborate it, not just for the audience, but for myself as well? Go ahead.
In the Islamic world and in the Arab world, you've got a lot of these corrupt elites and so on who align with American and indeed Zionist power in a strange sort of way to keep Islamism down. And Islamism is seen as their own fundamentalism, their enemy within, the danger that people will turn to the most fundamentalist current within their society and civilization. Now, moving out of that and looking at the Western world, which is a civilization based upon inverted premises to the Islamic world. The West, in my view, is an anti-theocratic and is an open-minded civilization. But the idea that because of that we don't believe in anything is an utter nonsense. Now, we have a fundamentalism of our own, and I think it's the guilty conscience of most Western intellectuals, particularly liberal-minded people in the arts. An enormous number of Western artists and writers and intellectuals, even through reversal and antagonism, were attracted to fascism in the first 30 to 40 years of the 20th century, and they were often attracted in an emotional way, at a level deeper than reason, because they were attracted to the discourses, the foundational and fundamentalist beliefs, classical and yet romantic, combined, of their own civilization. It's interesting to note, in relation to modernism, for example, many of the early modernists, Eliot, Wyndham Lewis, Marinetti, Celine, and Ezra Pound and so on, were deeply attracted to the extreme right. And they were attracted because they saw in it fundamentalist cultural energies. It's very interesting that late modernism has been taken up as the pet of the liberal establishment and completely denuded of nearly all of those energies, and it ended up in often sort of decadent and squalid vistas that sort of deconstruct almost everything the West is about and laugh whilst the process is going on. And yet even in that, I see a reaction against the foundational light, and I see the danger of European intellectuals being attracted to their fundamentalist discourses. Often with culture, you have to make things concrete, for example. Take the book about cinema that was written by Lucien Rabotet and Maurice Bardèche, which influenced Truffaut. Now, Truffaut, half-Jewish director, of course, Truffaut came to Britain to make a film in English, but the film is completely aesthetically French, because French cinema is extremely distinct within Western cinematography, very different to Anglo-American cinema. This was a film of Ray Bradbury's science fiction book, Fahrenheit 451, where books are burnt by firemen and nobody reads because books give people dangerous ideas. Now, the aesthetic of that film is deeply fascistic, and I believe is influenced by Rabotet, who knew Truffaut personally, because fascist theories in the 30s, including ex-communists and so on, were obsessed with cinema. Why were they obsessed with cinema? Because cinema is the mass art. It's the art of modernity that appeals to the intellectual and appeals to the man who's got almost no mind at all, because the images go straight onto his nervous system. It's an organic form of art that can appeal to the professor at one end and the road sweeper at the other. And, of course, it is the fine art of the modern age. Modernism turned inside the mind because replication of external reality became photographic. Cinema is the mass medium of modernity. It's why I've made films. It's also why communism and fascism were obsessed with cinema and obsessed with control of it. It's why Hitler wanted Fritz Lang to be head of German cinema after Metropolis in 1929.
Jonathan, I know you've got an excellent website. I would certainly appreciate if you could just say aloud for our audience exactly the address of your website.
Yes, it's www.jonathanbowden, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N-B-O-W-D-E-N.co.uk.
Oh, well, that's very easy because you're everywhere. I've seen you on Wikipedia, you're everywhere. And I certainly need to alert you folks, do listen to our friend Jonathan. He's an excellent speaker. I'm somewhat suspicious. I'll tell you about your art, your pictorial art. May I ask just a private question? Why do you actually sort of revel in those distorted figures of those ugly, almost degenerate faces of yours? I mean, are you talking about this, what do you pronounce it, Chtonic art, this primeval feelings that you so often mention in your books and in your artwork?
It's interesting. I think they sort of, partly because there are savage and ferocious forces in me, and I think you have to be truthful to them when you create. Probably the greatest artist in the Western tradition is Michelangelo, the greatest painter in the Western tradition is Botticelli, and yet the one who appeals to me most emotionally is Hieronymus Bosch. Modernism is partly a diabolical form of art, and I'm not an aesthetic conservative. I'm in part a revolutionary and a conservative. On the whole, left-wing people like my art, and right-wing people like the ideas contained in it, but don't like it. That's simplistic, but it's true. But I think you have to paint what's inside you. The Christian tradition is quite interesting here, because the most aesthetically interesting parts of the Christian tradition are the barak magnificence of sort of heavenly ardour, the building on light, the principle of light, you know, the sort of almost Albert Einstein idea, you know, of light cascading upon itself, the baroque, and the other potentiality is the demonic and the diabolical. I mentioned Gibson's film a moment or two ago, and in that film, the devil is an androgynous woman. And many people, including certain ultra-Catholics, who of course are close to Gibson conceptually, were rather put out by that. But in the Christian tradition, because the diabolical can never be known by man, the artist is free to interpret it to a degree with his own imagination. You see, I think the imagination is incredibly powerful, and I think imagination moves people more than reason. I think the reason people are attracted to the radical right, even though the forefront of their mind says they're not, is the power that it has. And that power is negative as well as positive. It's not just beauty. It's beauty and ugliness combined, synthesized, and even stepped beyond. So I suppose my aesthetics are Nietzschean in a way. I'm a sort of right-wing modern person in some ways. I would like the world to be different from what it is, obviously, but this is where I differ from Evola. Evola said there was three alternatives to modernity: suicide, being a Nietzschean, or getting rid of it all and destroying it and returning to absolute tradition based upon prior metaphysical realities. And a part of me wouldn't be opposed to that, and like pagan poets, like the American extremist Robinson Jeffers, for example. But at the same time, I think we're in the modern world, and what you have to do is turn its energies in an elitist way. One of the things that fascinates me is how, under the surface, images can be used. I once sat and watched the film 300. You know the Hollywood film?
I heard of it, but I didn't see it.
Which is based on a Frank Miller graphic novel. Now, David Duke did an analysis of that film. That's an anti-Persian and anti-Iranian film. It's partly, if you want to look at it in this way, a neoconservative film, if you know what I mean. And yet, if you turn the sound down and you look at it as a tableau of images, it's images, it's sepia tints, which relates to Renaissance, early Renaissance painting, people like Cimabue and Giotto. It's images from Leni Riefenstahl.
Yes, Leni Riefenstahl.
An image. Without any ideological overlay, you just look at the aesthetics of the heroic. Not who you were supposed to be against, not who we're supposed to be for, but you just look at the physiological aesthetic of the thing. Images are very powerful and can create different mental states in people. Goebbels wrote a novel when he was very young called Michael.
I read it, yes.
It's an expressionist novel, and it's a sort of left-right novel, if you like, when he was under the Strasser's influence. And somebody once asked him, because he was regarded as a Catholic fundamentalist, and somebody once said to him, "What is your view of God?" And he said, "My view of God is an eight-armed idol in darkness with flames around it, dancing girls and human sacrifice." It's almost Assyrian, isn't it? And somebody said to him, "Well, my doctor, my dear doctor, that's not very Christian, is it?" And he said, "You've mistaken me, my friend. That is Christ."
Jonathan, well, this is a fascinating discussion we've had, and I hope to have you more often here on my show. Folks, this was Jonathan Bowden. He's an, as I said, you've got to check his website. He's a great artist, and you can download his books. He was a man who was quite familiar with Lovecraft. He probably knows him by heart, and Carlyle, but he is a man also of tremendous classical erudition. You can ask him about Marlowe and Shakespeare. He cannot talk for hours. And Jonathan, it was nice to have you here. We'll have to go now. We'll part company, but I hope to catch up with you soon in London. Thank you very much for now, and bye for now.
Thanks very much.